Welcome to Extreme Genes on the Mormon Channel, brought to you by The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
Hello, genies, and welcome back to Extreme Genes, America's Family History Show. I am Fisher, your radio root sleuth, on the show where we shake your family tree and watch the nuts fall out. Hopefully you've had a productive week of digging up new ancestral stories, photographs, and information. This past week, I obtained what I believe to be a photo of my grandfather's older half-brother. Never saw one before. He was born in the 1860s and was a brother from the same mother as my grandfather, who was born in 1880. Until recently, I was unable to trace this great uncle anywhere. He and his wife had no kids, but by tracking down descendants of his wife's sisters, I found a woman in Missouri who supplied me with a picture of the man she believes to be my great uncle, James Moore. When I saw it, I knew she had to be right because he bears a striking resemblance to my grandfather. There's still more work to be done on this one, but you can see the pictures side by side on our Extreme Genes Facebook page, so check it out and give us a like. This marks the 73rd anniversary of the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor that led to our involvement in World War II. On the USS Arizona, two brothers were killed that morning, both of them young uncles to two other brothers now living in Tennessee, Charles and James Allison. Well, Charles and James recently dug up some documents relating to the deaths of their uncles and even contributed some of the material to a museum. We'll talk to the brothers about their uncle's story, how and why they joined the military, how they wound up on the Arizona, and the impact their deaths had on the family, coming up in about 7 minutes. Then later in the show, I'll be visiting with a true pioneer in DNA family history research, Dr. Scott Woodward. We'll be talking about the early days of this unique type of research, how it developed, and where we are now. I know you'll find it interesting. Our ExtremeGenes.com poll last week asked about what you thought about most when celebrating Thanksgiving. The number one answer, the family gathering, with 63%. Next were the blessings at 26%, followed by the food at 11%. No one thought most about pilgrims, football, or shopping. So there you go. Just a reminder, our free Extreme Genes podcast app is waiting for you to download to your iPhone or Android right now. So just go to your phone's app store and look under Extreme Genes. You can find and catch up on all of our past shows easily and quickly on your phone. You can hear all the experts with their tips and ideas who can help you learn more about your ancestors. It is time once again for your family histoire news from the pages of ExtremeGenes.com. And we start out with a very important announcement that came down in the last week about MyHeritage.com and Roots Magic software coming together to integrate MyHeritage's amazing record matching software with Roots Magic databases. Mike Booth, the technical vice president of Roots Magic, is on the phone to tell us about what this means to you and me. Hi, Mike. How you doing?
Great. How are you today?
Awesome. This is great news. We're hearing about the technology from MyHeritage.com coming over to Roots Magic. Explain how this works.
That's right. Well, last week we released a new version of our software, Roots Magic 7, and one of the neat new features is called Web Hints. And what this will do is, as you're looking there at your pedigree or your family there on the main screen, it will go in the background. It can search MyHeritage and also FamilySearch and look and see if there are any historical records on there that match the information that you have in your file.
So this is a lot like the records matching that goes on with MyHeritage.
That's right, and it's built into Roots Magic. It works really well. If there's a match, you'll see a little light bulb appear next to the name. You just click on it, and it will take you right to the MyHeritage website. You can see the records. If there's any information that you're missing, it'll tell you, oh, hey, we can add this information that you don't have, or we can improve on this date or this place that you as you have it in your file.
I love that about the technology with MyHeritage. If, for instance, if you wound up with extra names in a census record you didn't have in your group, all you have to do is click and it adds it to your record. How unbelievable is that?
Yeah, it's pretty slick. And the matching algorithms that MyHeritage uses are really, really advanced. I know as a programmer, when I wired in the web hints for the first time and just kind of watched it appear there on the screen, all these little light bulbs started appearing next to the names, and I clicked on them, and I found newspaper articles involving my great-grandfather, just all these records and things that I'd never seen before. And I'm pretty computer literate. I've known my way around these websites, and I've looked for stuff before, but I was able to find some real surprises, some things I'd never known were there before.
You know, I love technology that actually does the work for you while you're sleeping. It's a great way.
Yes.
Exactly. All right. Well, Mike, thanks so much, and congratulations. Sounds like a nice move forward for Roots Magic, along with the help of MyHeritage.com.
Yes. Thanks for your time.
This software is a game changer. You have got to check it out. Also in the news this week, more information on the DNA of King Richard III. You wouldn't think any more could be learned from one 500-year-old corpse, but that is not the case. The BBC is reporting on another DNA study of King Richard's remains, and it has everything to do with the royal bloodline. Now, maternal side DNA samples match those of living relatives, but paternal side DNA does not. Scientists say that doesn't mean the body wasn't Richard's. There's too much evidence to deny it. But what it does likely mean is female infidelity occurred somewhere down the line. The story's a little complicated, but it matters for a big reason. It brings into question the legitimacy of the Tudor claim to the British throne, or even Richard's claim to the throne. No one is expecting Queen Elizabeth will be vacating the throne over this, but it's still a fascinating study in DNA genealogy. See more of the details at extremegenes.com. And coming up next, I'll be talking to two brothers from Tennessee about their two uncles who both died on the USS Arizona at Pearl Harbor 73 years ago. That's in 3 minutes on Extreme Genes, America's Family History Show.
And welcome back to Extreme Genes, Family History Radio, America's Family History Show. I am Fisher, your radio root sleuth, with two guys from Tennessee, Charles and James Allison in Jackson. How are you guys?
We're doing fine.
Doing fine.
Well, I'm so excited to have you both on because you both have an amazing family history. And I found out about you guys through a newspaper story that was posted about your son, James, Christopher, and his wife, Suzanne, making a presentation to a local museum of a Franklin Roosevelt letter or certificate having to do with two of your relatives being killed on the USS Arizona in the raid at Pearl Harbor. Can you tell us about the certificates?
Yeah, they were issued sometime after the December 7th attack, and my grandmother and granddaddy Kennington would have received those certificates. Mother wound up with them, and then later, before she died, she gave them to me and also gave me letters that had been sent from one of the boys. I just put them in a drawer upstairs and forgot about them. And then over the years, the grandchildren that came along, I would take them upstairs and we'd get them out and let them look at it, see what their reaction was. And I never really got much reaction from any of them other than Chris and Suzanne's daughter, Ashley. She seemed extremely interested in it. So I'm in my 70s, and I figured that a good thing to do would maybe give her the certificate plus the letters plus one of them's Purple Heart. Charles has the other Purple Heart. That's what I did, and Suzanne took it all up, put it into a real nice frame with a picture of the son. And a friend of theirs was over one night, he and his family, for a dinner party, and he saw it, and he said, "Wow, do you know what you got here? I know somebody would be real interested in that."
Tell us about the two brothers now. These were uncles of yours, right?
Yes, I'll get in here. I live in a little town now just north of Jackson called Humboldt. And as it turns out, there's a man who's still alive up there who was a veteran of World War II. And he was in Europe. And he went through a lot of things over there and won, I think, the Silver Star and so forth. But anyway, he knew Milton and Cecil in high school. And as it turns out, both of them were football players. And one of them was much bigger than the other, and he had a nickname I can't remember, but it's kind of like big, you know. But I believe both of them, at least one of them, left school at the end of the 11th grade, so he didn't complete high school. But during the summer, I found this out from another fellow in Humboldt who was related to him. They worked on a local farm earning money because the family didn't have a lot of money, and that's when they enlisted. Now, one of the letters that I found recently, and it kind of blew my mind. I don't know why I missed it. Milton wrote a letter to my mother dated October the 9th, 1941. And he was telling about what they were doing and so forth, and about going over into Honolulu and so forth. But he mentioned in there, we will not be attacked by these Japanese. We're too strong for them to attack us. He made a prediction that, and less than 2 months later, he was dead.
Wow. Isn't that something? And you just found this recently.
Yeah. There were a lot of things that Mother had that we've gone through, and we're still finding things. Yeah.
Well, and isn't that the joy of family history, too, to experience that connection with those who have gone before and, of course, trying to put yourself in their shoes and what they thought and what they felt and what really was?
Well, I have another thing that I remember. I'm a little bit older than James, so I can remember some of those things during that time. I do recall, as a young boy, I must have been about 5 or 6. This was after their deaths. I can still see my mother standing at the sink, washing dishes, and crying and saying, "Oh, Milton, oh, Cecil, I miss you so much."
Oh.
Very tragic, you know. It's hard, I think, for us to put ourselves in their place. This family, Kennington, with 15 children in that family, 2 of the children died young, then 13 of them lived adulthood. The oldest of the 15 was killed in the First World War, and he was decorated, got the, I don't know if you're familiar with this French.
I think it's the Croix de Guerre.
Yeah, he received the Croix de Guerre, and I had the certificate. I gave that to my second son with a picture. It's a big picture of this son. His name was Lloyd, in his army hat and uniform. Also, I had the letters that he had written from when he was in the trenches during World War One, talking about what was going on. He said, tell one of his sisters that her friend so-and-so was killed yesterday, sort of like you were there type thing.
Yes.
So the family history that starts with that oldest brother then comes down to the 2 youngest that were killed at Pearl Harbor.
On the Arizona. Isn't that something?
On the Arizona.
Is there a long military history within your family? Did you have people in the Civil War?
It'd be hard to
tell you all of them. We got a lot of
from this area and not have had people in the Civil War. Now, I will tell you that not all of them were in the Confederate Army, though. My grandmother, Kennington, the mother of these 2 boys, her father actually was in the Union Army, and she was a Republican. And this would have been back in the 30s, 40s, 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s. And there probably weren't 6 Republicans in all of West Tennessee. And there just weren't any Republicans, but she was a Republican. That would have gone back to the Civil War.
Interesting. So you had you literally had the brother against brother scenario in the Civil War. Well, tell us about the boys now. The boys on the Arizona, you didn't know them, obviously, or you were very, very young, especially you, Charles. You might have some memory of them. Well, what stories, what were they like, and how is it that they wound up in Pearl Harbor?
Well, I've studied that, and what had happened is they both joined the Navy. And for a period of time, they were on the East Coast aboard the Arizona. And then, for whatever reason, they decided to move the Arizona to the Pacific. And so they told some stories about the ship sailing around down South America and winding up at Pearl Harbor. Now, they spent a lot of time on military maneuvers, practicing warfare and all that sort of stuff. But this particular time, they, along with many others, were docked, of course, in Pearl Harbor. And by the way, I want to ask you, have you ever been out there?
Yes, I have. And it's a very sacred place.
Well, I might cry. I was in the Marine Corps, and we came back and stopped in Honolulu. And some of us decided to go out there. And what caught me was the people were just chattering away before we got on that little boat to go out there to the memorial. Actually, the one that's there now wasn't built at that time. But as soon as we got to the memorial, dead silence, out of respect for these young men that died there. I don't know if you experienced that, but they
it was it was a very similar experience. Yes.
Now, one of them joined the Navy a year to 2 years before the other one. So originally, they were not on the Arizona together. The one that I think joined earlier, he was on the Arizona, and then they started working to get the other brother on the Arizona so that they'd be together. And I think they were on the Arizona together for probably about a year before they died. Of course, we're talking about the 30s when they joined the Navy, and there were a lot of young men that joined the military. In particular, 39 and 40, as things began to heat up, these families were involved. They were in the Depression. They had large families. They had no way to feed them. So the military was a way to have food. It was a way to have shelter, and it was also a way to have some money. I know in some of the letters that they wrote home, they talk to my granddaddy Kennington about the fact they had sent him a check. Evidently, he and Grandmother Kennington set up on an allotment so they got a certain percentage of their wages so they could support the rest of the family. So the South really did not begin to come out of the Civil War economically until World War II.
Wow.
Everything was so destroyed after that war, the economy, the way of life. Consequently, economically, you had the sharecroppers. You had a few people that had a lot. You had most people that didn't have anything.
And I'm going to go back a little bit into their high school years. Of course, both of them played football on a local high school football team. One of them was much bigger than them, so he was a lineman. The other was in the backfield, and they apparently enjoyed it. Unfortunately, they just didn't have any money in the family, so they left school and joined the Navy.
There was one other thing that Charles found out later, was that Milton played trumpet in the band in high school. Then when he was in the Navy, of course, they found out about that, so they had him playing a bugle on the Arizona. So,
isn't that something?
What I've read, they used people with bugles to call people to general quarters or taps, reveille, all those different things. You got all that military history, but as far as being a military family, I don't really look upon us as a military family.
Well, I don't know how you can think not, though, James. It's amazing. You got the Civil War, you got World War One, you got World War Two. You probably have the Spanish-American War in there, too, somewhere.
Yeah, we have the American Revolutionary War. That's all documented.
Well, it sounds like quite a family history, gentlemen, and I think it's a great thing you're doing in sharing some of that with the museums and sharing your stories with us today, and we sure appreciate it, and, of course, the sacrifice your family has made over many, many years. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you, Scott.
Thank you, Scott.
And coming up next, he's a pioneer in family history DNA research. He's Dr. Scott Woodward, and he will fill you in on how it all got started and the benefits he's seen since his early vision of how to unlock our family history from within our own bodies. That's in 5 minutes on Extreme Genes, America's Family History Show. Welcome back to Extreme Genes Family History Radio and ExtremeGenes.com. I am your radio root sleuth, Fisher, along with my special guest, Dr. Scott Woodward. I guess I'd call you a pioneer, Scott, in DNA, because the first time I met you, it's many years ago, and you would never have any recollection of this, you drew my blood to get DNA. What year would that have been, roughly?
That was at least a decade ago.
At least.
And we've moved a long ways from that, but when we started a decade or more ago trying to connect genealogy with the sciences of DNA and genetics, really was a pioneering effort, I think. There weren't very many people out there that were really looking at that. But since that time, there's been a tremendous amount of growth in both our ability to analyze that DNA, to collect that DNA. We no longer collect blood.
Yes.
We can do it from a cheek swab, a
spit,
saliva.
Yeah.
A lot of different ways to be able to analyze DNA. And we have literally tens of thousands, even 100,000s of people now that have been tested with various DNA tests that can be connected and looked at for connections.
Well, I do remember back in those times, and the story was brand new. It was like, wow, we can take your blood, we can tell maybe where you're from, maybe who you're tied into. But it was a long time before we heard anything back about anything, because you were still getting a certain level of samples together to begin to come to certain conclusions. And that wasn't that long ago. And from where we are now with analyzing clades and all these different backgrounds and movements of populations, it's astonishing.
You're right. It needed a certain critical mass to be able to get some data back to the individuals.
I'm realizing I was a pioneer. I was a part of that. He was sucking my blood to figure this out.
You were a pioneer. And that's what we told these people when we started out a decade ago, is that, you know, we're not going to be able to give you any results back right now because there aren't any results to be had.
But you had a certain number you were going to hit, I remember.
100,000.
That's right.
We were after 100,000 individuals. We met that goal, but it was long before 100,000 people that we realized that this was going to work.
Mm-hmm.
At the beginning, we thought we were going to need 100,000 people just to see whether or not the process would work.
And these were folks all over the world, as I recall.
Yes.
And so you were going to different populations in different continents and, yes. and in different regions within those continents to try to identify what moved to where potentially, right?
Yes, and it wasn't just that, but we also had some very strict requirements on the individuals that we collected for the database. We needed them to donate their DNA, but we also needed additional information from them. We needed genealogical information.
Right.
We needed parents, grandparents, great-grandparents.
But you needed places, even more.
Places of birth of those individuals so that we could place the genes that we could get from your DNA into the various places in the past so that when an unknown person came in that didn't know anything about who they were, where they came from, we could compare their DNA with these pools of DNA that we had collected and say, where do they best fit in? And that's what needed the 100,000 or so
right.
to go. But we realized by the time we hit 20,000 that, hey, this is going to work.
This is happening, yeah.
And there were some populations that we could answer questions for right then.
Well, and as I recall at the time, in talking to others who were interested in doing this, you know, we knew you were coming by, you were going to do these sampling. People are going, they're going to take my DNA. I mean, what are they going to do with that? I mean, there was a big privacy concern then that I just don't see people dealing with now.
That's correct. There was, and you know, there needs to continue to be a very strict privacy and confidentiality requirement placed on these DNA samples. But as people became more and more educated about what we could and could not do with your DNA, people became much more amenable to the idea of collecting their DNA, putting them in data sets and databases, and to be able to reconstruct genealogy. So today, there's not as many concerns as there were early on. But we still maintain and try and maintain that level of security and privacy and confidentiality of your samples because we realize that it's a very valuable piece of who you are.
So let me ask you this then. We see those numbers up on websites. Those are not things that you're concerned about, obviously, for privacy because pretty much anybody can see these long lists of who you match up with names. That's not the kind of privacy you're concerned about. Yes?
That's correct. All of the people who are participating in DNA for genealogical services are looking for matches. They're looking for people who connect with them. Those numbers that you see that are up on these websites are good numbers, good DNA pieces that can be used to connect people together, but they don't give you much information about any
medical stuff.
Exactly. Medical predispositions or anything like that. And so those are left out. Those aren't public.
Is there anybody who could actually come along and look at those numbers and say, aha, he has a 7 in this position, therefore this is a person with an inclination towards, you know, whatever it is? There really isn't any concern about that, is there?
The easy answer to that is no. And then you have to condition that because I'm a scientist that says, well, maybe there's some infinitely small possibility that someone could derive something from that, but that would be extremely rare.
So from that very early study that you were doing, it is a thrill to see the communities that are out there that have developed around this science, including professors and doctors like yourself who are actually there to just kind of consult, and they love kind of visiting with people and sharing their insight on what they see in their numbers.
A little more than a decade ago, in fact, this started on August 11th of 1999, at least my involvement in this, so we're 15 years out. this discipline didn't exist.
Right.
It just didn't exist. And so we're talking 15 years to build this community or sets of communities throughout the world now that are actively engaged in searching for ancestors and connections using genetic information.
Can you give us a story or two about a connection that interests you?
There are literally dozens of them, but one, just with my wife, there's always been the family story that there was African-American heritage in her lineage. And it's just been a story because we've never been able to find any documentation that would support that story. But we had some suspicions about where on the line that may have been.
And did you have photographs?
No photographs until just recently, but the photographs actually came after the fact of what I'm going to tell you. But there were some names and some possibilities. My wife is from Missouri, and we thought we knew where this African-American may have come in. There was a story of perhaps a mulatto that was in this line. But, I mean, we'd completely hit dead ends as far as documentation and what might be going on there. And so when we looked at her DNA and her father's DNA, which then matched on certain parts, and using the autosomal test, it was very clear that both in her father and in my wife, there were the percentages of African-American alleles of autosomal genes that were present that would suggest exactly the correct generation that we thought that this person was half African.
Wow.
And it fit almost too good, almost like Mendel's peas. I mean, you look at those numbers and you say, you know, this is a setup. Someone set this up. But that's exactly what it was. And so we now have a lot of supporting evidence from the genetics that say, yes, the family stories, in fact, were correct. Let's dig those out of the closet. Let's look a little more closely at those and see where that leads us. Since that time, we have found the pictures. We have found other documentation that would suggest that we're correct and we're down the right line.
So as a scientist, though, it's very hard for you ever to say, this is it, this is correct, this is the person. But when you look at it as a genealogist, because obviously you are, you take that as just one piece of the evidence, right? And then you put it all together, you get the story, and you kind of realize this couldn't fail to be that person.
It's very difficult for me to say absolute.
Right. in anything you do.
But I will go to 99.8 on this
one. Okay. Well, that's pretty extreme for you. I like that. Extreme genes right there.
Scott, it's always great having you on the show. Thanks for coming by. Coming up next, it is Tom Perry, our preservation authority on family history gifts you can throw together fast when we return in 3 minutes on Extreme Genes, America's Family History Show.
It is time to talk preservation on Extreme Genes, Family History Radio, America's Family History Show. Tom Perry is back from TMCPlace.com. Hi, Tom. Good to see you.
Good to be here.
You know, I was talking to some friends the other day, and they're already thinking about next year and family reunions.
Exactly.
And I thought, you know, this might be a good time to talk about it as people are making plans for that. Talk to us about how people figure out, for instance, how to exchange old photos and documents at places where they gather.
Oh, yeah. One of the best things to do is when you're planning a family reunion, whether it's at Mount Rushmore or Yellowstone, or you might even do your family reunion at Rootstech, that would be an awesome place to have a family reunion, because the ones that are interested in Rootstech stuff go to Rootstech. The ones that want to do family history go to the Family History Library. The ones that want to go deer hunting can go deer hunting. There's so many different things that are going on
Out
in Salt Lake. Yeah, skiing. And there's a lot of places across the country that have do-it-yourself help. Because with photos, usually everybody wants them. But you have a videotape, and you could have a two-hour, like, say, a video 8 tape or VHS tape. Everybody doesn't want all that stuff.
Snippets.
Yeah, exactly. That's what they want is snippets. And so what we have at our new Garland location is we have like six little workstations where people can come in and queue up their videotapes. They can transfer them to digital formats, their audio tapes. They can actually take their old 8mm and Super 8 film. We have a little crank machine so it won't damage the film, because a lot of times people get old film, pop in their projector, flip it on, and it shatters their film because it's so old and brittle.
Right.
And that just scares me. So we have a little crank machine with a little light bulb that if for some reason you take a lunch break and forget to turn the light bulb off, no big deal, it's not going to melt your film. And you can just go through it. We'll show you how you can sit there and edit out the stuff that you don't want and put it in a separate bag.
So you do lessons on that?
Oh, absolutely.
Really?
Oh, yeah. We'll sit right down there with you and do it. So you're sitting there going through. We'll show you how to cut it. We'll show you how to splice it together, pick out what parts you want. Because what we've had some people do is they come in and say, hey, I want to make this reel for the family, But this stuff of Jenny out at college, none of us are really interested in, but she'll want it. So let's splice that out and start that on a new reel. So they bring in like 150-foot reels, and then they break them into family stuff, and then they can break it in these different reels. So then once we transfer it to DVD or Blu-ray or a thumb drive or whatever they want, they've got separate ones for each person.
It's already been edited to a great extent. Yeah,
it's been edited. Same thing with slides. They can come in and scan all the slides. We'll show them how to put them into different folders. They can put them by years. They can have subfolders within the years. It says Jenny's first day at camp or Tommy's football games. And then they're broken down into smaller and smaller things. So if somebody wants to look at their old football highlights, they don't have to dig through all this other stuff. They've got these different levels within the folders they want. And then if they get something like Heritage Collectors, which we talked about a few weeks ago, they can get that software, which will tie into all the folders and make searching a snap. It makes it really, really easy and fast.
That's where you like highlight an individual in a photo, and it'll bring you a drop down, and you can click on audio and hear from that person or read about their statistics or read about some of their history or lead them to other photos.
Oh, absolutely. If you come to Roots Tech or any place that's near any of our locations, you can schedule a time to come in and we can sit down with the whole family or individuals and work on getting all your pieces put together. Then you can take them home and transfer them if you want to yourself. You can leave them with us. We can transfer them for you. Or find wherever you're going, make some phone calls and see if there's some do-it-yourself centers there. You can go and basically do it yourself.
I think this would be a great way to do a family reunion because there's so many things to do in a reunion center.
Oh, yeah.
It's entertainment for the kids as well as all this for preservation.
It's the absolute best way to do a family reunion. We've done family reunions where I remember where everybody went to one place. There was one thing to do. Some people had a blast. Some people were bored. They were just there for the family. If you plan it around some other activities, so everybody's taken care of. So all the family's happy. You get together in the evening, show the stuff you've worked on, and you have the greatest family reunion ever.
That's Tom Perry from TMCPlace.com, the Preservation Authority. And that was great stuff on the family reunions earlier. What do you have now?
Okay, we have a lot of people come in to our store or drop off at some of our drop-off centers across the country, and they say, I want to transfer my film. How's the best way to do it? So we show them several different options. We show them what high def looks like, what standard transfers look like. And I always like to go high def with film because we do it in the full 16 by 9, so you see the edges. The edges aren't cut off. If you do it in standard format, the edges are going to be cut off, and there could be Aunt Margaret there that you never get to see, or your mom or somebody that's passed away in your family that you never got to see, because they were too close to the edge of the frame. So we do high def. They say, oh, okay, I want to do high def. And I have this stack of videotapes and VHSCs and these different things, and I want them done in high def also. Well, you don't want to do high def in videotape. There's no real reason to do it because videotape is an electronic format. So it is actually being changed from the electronic format into binary code, which is zeros and ones. So there is no high def. The only thing you can do is you can go in and take the electronic signal, and if it's waving a little bit, sometimes you can stabilize it, or if the colors are off, you can go through a color processor, what we call a proc amp, and kind of adjust the colors that have kind of faded over playing your tape for so long. But high def doesn't make any difference. And also, everybody knows, Blu-ray holds more information, so Blu-ray is high def, thinking that a Blu-ray disc is actually better. It's not the disc that's better, it's the way it's interpolated by the DVD player. So you can take a regular DVD that was made before they even had Blu-ray, but yet play it in a Blu-ray player and will automatically up-convert the signal, make the signal stronger so it actually looks better.
Really?
Yeah, so there's no purpose. People come in and say, oh, I want my videotapes on Blu-ray so they'll look better. Well, no, they won't look any different. And so I tell them, just go to DVD because people in your family aren't going to have Blu-ray machines.
Yeah, right, some won't have them.
Right, so this way the DVD can play it. If you want yours to look better, if you've got a nice Blu-ray system, play that DVD in your Blu-ray and it'll upconvert it. But then when you want to go into high-def film, it's totally different. You do want to go to Blu-ray because it's taking your film. It's actually, the light is penetrating through the film. And so the better the pixel count, so to speak, is, just like when you're doing printing,
yes,
the more pixels, the better it's going to look. That's the same thing with the film, is you have this CMOS or CCD chip that is picking up the light as it's going through the film. And it's saying, okay, this is this color, this is this color, this is how much this is. So it's taking all this information and making it look better. So that's why you want to be really, really careful. Wherever you get your film done, make sure they scan your film, that they're not projecting it on a screen and then shooting it, because when it goes through the projector onto a screen, it's going to be diminished by what kind of screen.
Of course.
A glass screen, a white wall, whatever. And then the CMOS or chip has to pick up the reflection off the screen.
Right, so you're automatically going to lose quality.
Oh, absolutely.
Easily.
Absolutely.
In fact, depth, I would think.
Oh, yeah. There are some people that do it in their back room, and I've had people come in and show me stuff that, I mean, it was hideous. It was actually keystoned, which means it was shaped like a V.
Right, yeah.
Because they didn't have the camera lined up just right. Because if the camera's a little bit over from the projector, in order to get them to line up better, they're going to have to move farther and farther away from the screen so there's not that depth of field problem.
And yet we should mention that that's not a bad way to go if you're trying to capture a photograph off of a television, right?
Exactly. The way that we transfer it, we actually scan the film. The light's going through the film. It's going to a CMOS chip inside the camera, and it's immediately being transferred. That way we can give you JPEGs for every frame of film.
Unbelievable. And, of course, that does some great things because it means you can get photographs from a single frame of film. We're out of time, Tom. Great to see you again. We'll talk to you again next week.
Sounds good. See you then.
Thanks once again to our guests, Charles and James Allison from Tennessee, for sharing their stories of their two uncles who died on the USS Arizona at Pearl Harbor 73 years ago this weekend. Also to Dr. Scott Woodward for taking us back to the beginning of DNA family history research. Whatever you missed, you can catch on our podcast. Talk to you again next week. And remember, as far as everyone knows, we're a nice, normal family.
This has been Extreme Genes on the Mormon Channel. Brought to you by The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Share your family story by going to FamilySearch.org.